you all for coming. As Bill said, my name is Mouse, also known as Marty Tilson, and for the moment, I'm a student at Reed College. I've been doing work with Lainey here, organizing an ICRIS project group that meets on our campus. My status as a student kind of seems to change as often as the weather here in Portland does, but I'm human, and you know, every day we're somebody a little different. So I first discovered the ICRIS project in a friend's laundry room this past August while I was hitchhiking through New Paltz, New York. The publication Navigating the Space Between Brilliance and Madness was sitting on the washing machine, and reading it was just this incredible experience for me. I mean, I didn't leave that room for a good 2 hours or so. It felt like I was having a conversation with a good friend, but it was a conversation I'd never actually had before. Because as I'm sure many of you understand, mental illness is a very touchy subject for people. So many of you are probably already familiar with the ICRIS project and the mission, and I know that Will's going to talk more about this later. But for the benefit of those who are not, it's a group that aims to form communities of mad individuals and their allies who want to change the way that we think and talk and act about mental issues. So this dialogue is so important and so crucial, but it's largely absent in most areas. So, I mean, to be told that you're sick because of the way that you experience the world around you, because you feel and communicate differently than the majority of people, is incredibly isolating. Most people would rather defer to psychiatric authority and keep their problems behind closed doors instead of talking about it with, you know, friends and fellow mad people. So, but I believe this is where the conversation should really be happening, with other people who can actually say, you know, this is how my mind works. You know, what about yours? Or this helped me, what helps you? Like I said, we're changing every day. So the things that keep each of us stable right now might not help in a week or a year. So fortunately, there are a lot of different options out there, as you'll know if you ask around or talk to people or do some research. So back in October, when I first thought of forming an ICRIS group at Reed College, the director of the counseling center told me that it had been 20 years since the campus had seen a peer-run discussion and support group for mental health. I mean, this just shocked the hell out of me. I mean, here we are. We're in a small liberal community with a very stressful environment and a very fairly high prevalence of mental eccentricities, but for 20 years, no one thought it would be beneficial for us to talk to one another about it. I mean, college can be rough, but we're all in it together at roughly the same point in our lives, of the same generation, and experiencing many of the same difficulties dealing with academic life and getting to know your peers and living in dorms. You know, still, it's easy to feel alone, isolated, and different, and afraid of being judged. So what do? We meet every Sunday in a safe space on campus and just discuss our experiences. We try to come up with accurate ways of describing how we are different instead of relying on blanket definitions like bipolar or clinically depressed or psychotic and so on. We look critically at how madness is portrayed by the media and medical establishments and how it is perceived by others. We, most importantly, I think, make friends and form a community of people who understand and care honestly about each other's well-being. I mean, to me, madness is not an illness. It's a dangerous space to navigate, but the gift of thinking differently is invaluable, I think, especially in the culture we live in today. So I wouldn't trade my superpowers for anything in the world, is what I'm trying to say. But it takes a lot to get to the point of having pride in your differences, particularly when you have to be constantly mindful of the pitfalls and problems that come along with them. So just remember to talk to each other and support each other. And if ICRIS interests you, there's the literature on the table back there. There's a wonderful website you can go to. Our meetings happen on the Reed College campus every Sunday. I know there's also a regional meeting at People's Co-op in Southeast, also on Sundays. And you can always talk to me. That's cool too. So, thank you.
Wow, I think I surprised you because I said you were going to go second, and then you ended up going first, so sorry about that. So I want to introduce Jason Renaud, who's going to say a few words about the Mental Health Association of Portland, which is one of the other co-sponsors of tonight's event. So here's Jason Renaud.
Hi. I'm Jason Renaud. I'm an advocate in the mental health and addictions community for about 30 years here in Portland. I grew up here, right here. I know what was in this building before it was the Process Center, and before that, and before that, and before that, and before that, several iterations. This is my community, And I'm very proud, and you're very brave to stand up here and say those words. So thank you very much. It's very hard to be a mental health advocate because you are, just by saying who you are, breaking down barriers. Thank you. Well, it's organizations like ICRIS that help you do that and help people speak about that. And I grew up in an alcoholic recovery home, so I grew up steeped in the traditions of the 12 steps and the 12 traditions, so peer support and peer advocacy made sense to me. So when I got in the mental health side, and I was told in order to get well, you need to go through this elaborate medical process, bureaucratic process, it just didn't ring true to me. And I got into mental health advocacy and helping people who are very ill talk about their illness and get well, especially also navigate the homeless system, navigating the criminal justice system. And I haven't met anybody yet who has a mental health diagnosis who said, I'm satisfied with this bureaucratic medical process that I'm trying to go through. Whereas I meet people every day in the 12-step and 12 traditions process that I'm getting well, and it's me who's doing it. So that difference has made me seek for years a different system, a different idea of understanding oneself around the mental health side, not really around the addiction side. And I was hanging out in the Portland Zine Symposium one day, wandering around, thinking of, you know, what can I find here that's curious, and I met these people who had this book, and I opened this book, and it's got all this stuff, and it's called the ICRIS Project, and it's very, very wonderful. And I'm just excited about this. I buy half a dozen copies. I give them all away within an hour. And like 2 days later, I'm in the coffee shop right around the corner here, and I'm just standing there with my cup of coffee. And one of the etiquette rules with coffee shops is you're not supposed to look at other people's laptop screens. Right? Have you ever had that experience? I'm not going to look at what you're looking at. You know, and it's cool because everybody's kind of doing what they're supposed to do, but, you know, you're not supposed to do that. And I just happened to be looking at this guy's laptop screen. And it has on it the ICRIS Project. I said, oh, well, I'm going to really violate the ethos of the coffee shop and introduce myself to this person and say, I've been looking at your laptop screen. And I'm really interested in what you're looking at, and it's Will Hall. And I said, of course you're the one who would be looking at your laptop screen in this coffee shop right next to where I grew up. You're from Northampton, Massachusetts, and of course you would be here, so. Hail fellow, well met. The next day, he calls a bunch of, he's here for the Alternatives Conference, the biggest mental health consumer conference in the nation, happens to be happening here a couple of days later. He says, I'll help you publicize this big event that you're doing tomorrow or next week, which was the memorial for a young man who was killed by the police here in Portland named James Chassie. And we had 650 people show up. 100 of them were from the Alternatives Conference. They just they had candles, and they marched from their hotel through the streets of Portland to the memorial, sat in the balcony. It was beautiful. So we have two projects this month, or this year, with the Mental Health Association of Portland. One is we're making a documentary film about what happened to James Chassie. And if you don't know what happened to James Chassie, come to our website. It's on the screen, and you can learn about it. As a person who, a lifelong resident of Portland, gentle artist character. We knew him in the mental health medical bureaucracy, and we knew him, I knew him as a friend. And he was beaten to death by the police, and very little has occurred with those particular officers to change their behaviors. A lot has happened in the city around what happened to James and changing how the city approaches mental health issues, around how the mental health bureaucracy approaches people with mental illness who are acutely ill, and about how the legal system is going to address people who are within the mental health system. So that's changing rapidly, and we're making a film about that. The other thing we're doing is a interactive theater project. This is kind of fun. Kathy Clemens, who's not here yet, has been organizing something called From the Inside Out, and I urge you to come to our website and learn more about this. This is an opportunity to, again, speak out about who you are and help reduce the stigma of mental illness in our community. So thank you, for Will, and thanks for letting us me speak.
Thanks a lot, Jason. I had actually forgotten the whole story of the laptop and how we maybe like weird synchronicities like that are happening so often to me that I kind of start to take them for granted, but that was pretty amazing. So thanks, Jason, thanks, Mouse, and thanks to the Process Work Institute and to Caroline.
Where's Caroline?
There you are. Thank you so much for organizing this and all your work putting this together. I'm really nervous right now. I have like my notes here, but I was diagnosed with schizophrenia, and one of the things that would happen to me that was called a symptom, and this is part of your psychosis, is that I would be in a room full of people and I would feel like they were all staring at me. So right now, that's sort of like what's real and what's not real has always been a big theme in my life. So it's very exciting to be part of a program, Process Work, where reality is itself called into question. I encourage you to check out some of the books from the Institute that are on the table, as well as the Icarus Project books. So I got my notes here, and I got some backup with the two presenters that we had earlier, which was really great. And I don't want to take too much time, but I guess I just want to, first of all, just recognize the diversity of people that we have here today. I mean, there's faculty from the school. There's people who have lived through different states of madness, have been in the system. There's a lot of people who are professionals involved with mental health. There's a lot of skill and wisdom and knowledge, and I really just want to recognize that. And I want to create as much of an opportunity as we can tonight to hear from people and hear comments and ideas and have a dialogue and ask questions. And so I'm going to try and keep my own presentation kind of short, but I want to do about 30, 35 minutes or so, if that's okay, and then we can see how we're feeling and then maybe do a break. Or did you have a question? Or hold the mic up. Okay. Scared of this thing. So can everybody hear me okay? So I was thinking of doing about 30 or 35 minutes presentation, and then we can have our dialogue and discussion and questions. Does that sound about right, Suika? And just let me know how we're doing, and if anybody needs anything. What does that mean, if anybody needs anything? It means I'm nervous. I don't know what exactly to say, but thank you. That's, I wanted to hear from the audience a little bit. So thank you. And I guess the thing about all the different perspectives, there is a perspective that we don't often hear, the mental health issue, and that's the experience of people who have been through madness and been diagnosed ourselves. There's a huge professional literature and a professional industry about telling people what they're going through, but it's very rare for us to actually hear from people ourselves what we've been through. So I'm going to be presenting that from my point of view, and also from a disability rights point of view, talking about the work that I've been doing over the past 6 years. And I think that what's exciting to me about the Process Work Institute and doing this event here is that really this is one of the key things about process work, is really respecting diversity. And so I really want to welcome all the different voices and perspectives that are in the room today. And we have this idea of deep democracy in process work, where everything is really is supposed to be here. Everything belongs where we are in this moment. And so I know that there are people who are taking medication who are here, and that's, you're welcome to be here. There are people who choose not to take medication. There are people who identify themselves with a mental health label or who don't identify themselves with a mental health label. That's completely fine. Everybody's experience is really welcome here. And that, I think, is one of the messages of the Icarus Project and the work that I've done with the Freedom Center, is really trying to learn from different perspectives and really hear from each other. The disability rights piece of the presentation is really one of the essence of the disability rights movement, is the idea of independent living. The movement really started getting going in the 70s as people were pushing for the right to be out of hospitals, people with physical mobility limitations or issues, and had been historically kept in hospitals and wanted the right to live in the community. So one of the things I'm going to be talking about is the importance of diversity and the importance of a disability rights perspective around mental health, and how self-determination and choice are really key parts about that. And the word disability itself is a little bit, it's kind of a strange word, because as Mouse was talking about, a lot of us don't feel that we're disabled. We feel that we have differences that maybe are not mainstream, that are not majority, that aren't considered normal, but as valid as anybody else's experience. They may be tied up with suffering, they may be very painful, but they also have positive sides. And so maybe the concept that we want to think of and work with is the idea of diverse ability, that we all have different kinds of abilities and should be recognized for that. So a little bit about my story. So I guess going all the way back into my childhood, I had pretty strong and pretty powerful experiences that were dissociative or going out of my body or becoming very, very terrified or just very, very confused by what was going on around me. And this never was really recognized or acknowledged or helped by any of the adults around me or my parents when I was growing up. And then growing up, I kind of got this word for it, depression. And it was like something that just sort of made me disengage from reality and just not want to be part of things around me. And that was kind of the word that I got for it. It was very tied up with sadness and kind of feeling paralyzed and withdrawn. And I kind of learned over the years that, you know, that word can be very confusing. It seems to say a lot, depression, but it also maybe doesn't say very much. And that what I was going through was very different, very, very extreme in a lot of ways. And I kept struggling with these states and just feeling like I didn't understand what was going on around me or able to communicate with other people. And I had been through a lot of different kinds of therapy, and I tried to do a different, I tried to go to a different therapy center. It was called the Bay Area Depression Treatment Center. And I went there, and within one session, I had a prescription for Prozac. And they had sent me to a doctor, and I got a prescription. I actually came out of my first doctor's meeting with a free sample of Prozac. So I started to take Prozac, and at first, it was wonderful. It was like the best cup of coffee I'd ever had in my life. I just started taking Prozac, and I had all this energy that I didn't have before. I started getting up earlier and going to work earlier and getting a lot of work done, and just really active and outgoing. I was really, my spirits were really being lifted up and lifted up and lifted up, and pretty soon my spirits were kind of lifted off into outer space. And what happened was that I had a manic reaction from the Prozac. And now that is much more recognized. The mental health establishment and the warnings that are given to people recognize more, not totally, but more, that mania can be a reaction to the medication. But at the time, I didn't really know what was going on. I started to, I'd never really had any kind of episode like that before. And I started to do very strange things at work. I got into arguments with people. I would dress very, very weird and sort of talk about religious beliefs and all these kinds of things. And I ended up losing that job that I had, a very important kind of career job that I had right after leaving college, which was really, really shameful and humiliating. And I was alienated from all of my coworkers and a lot of my friends in the community that I was a part of. And it took me about 5 or 6 years to really make the connection that I was having a reaction to the medication, because the experience was so overwhelming for me. And today, this still is something that happens to people who are on antidepressants, and sometimes they are warned and it's acknowledged and seen what's going on. But other times, you get a prescription for Prozac, you start to take it, you get a manic reaction, and they say, oh, well, now you're bipolar. We thought you were depressive, but actually you're bipolar. And now we're going to put you on even heavier medication. So it's still a problem. It's getting more talked about. But at the time, I was clueless. All I knew was that my career had kind of ended. I started working in a different job that was not, I had been working in an environmental movement, and now I was working just in an office, an insurance company office. And my life really started to unravel, and a lot of the problems that I had had with being withdrawn from other people and really starting to feel like there were these kind of entities that would enter my head and start to control me and say things to me, it's really started to get worse and worse. And I think I was on a downward spiral that had a lot to do with poverty, isolation, things, malnutrition, kind of feeding back in on each other. And it reached a point, I was in San Francisco, where my days and nights were all turned around. I would just wander the streets, and I would see people, and I would be convinced that they were trying to hurt me, or I knew what they were thinking about me. I was so afraid of my housemates that I would leave through the window of our apartment because I didn't want them to know that I was in the apartment or not in the apartment. And so I was in really, really bad shape, and I really needed help, and I really wanted help. And up until that point, I had tried medication, and I had tried talk therapy, and I really didn't know what else to do. And I said, well, okay, I think I want to try a different kind of medication, because that was really the only thing that was being offered that I knew of. And so my therapist said, well, go to this public clinic where I had, because I didn't have any money and I didn't have any other access to a psychiatrist or anything like that. So go to this public clinic and just ask them to give you a different medication. So I went to this public clinic on Gough Street in San Francisco, Mount Zion Crisis Center. And I probably should have known what was going on, because it wasn't just a clinic that you walk into. You go up to the front door, and there's an intercom, and then you buzz yourself, you say who you are, and then they buzz you in, and the door buzzes, you walk in, and then the door locks behind you. So I did an interview with a number of different people, and they kept telling me that the doctor was going to see me soon. The doctor would see me in an hour, the doctor would see me in half an hour, and I was there for about 7 or 8 hours, and I got a number of interviews from people, but I never was able to see a doctor. And what they were doing is that they were observing me, they were watching me, they were trying to figure out what was going on with me. They would ask me, well, are you suicidal? And I'd say, yeah, I'm suicidal. It's like, well, how suicidal are you? I mean, I wanted help, and I wanted them to really know the depth of the suffering that I was going through. Do you have a plan? Yeah, I have a plan. Yeah, I definitely have a plan. Oh, what is it? Okay, and I would tell them what I was going to do. And I was basically just walking right into a forced hospitalization situation. And at no point did they ask me, well, do you want to be hospitalized? Do you think that that might be helpful? Because if I had had that dialogue with them, I might have said, yeah, I do actually want to be in the hospital, or I might not. But I didn't really have that opportunity to have that discussion. And in fact, when the 9 o'clock came around and they closed the clinic, and I said, well, I'm going to go home now. They said, well, we're not letting you go. We're going to hospitalize you. My reaction was, well, I want to go to work. I mean, I had already lost one job as a result of the mental health struggles that I was going through. And I didn't want that to happen again. I wanted to go back to work. And I told them, look, I'm not going to kill myself. I can make a no harm contract. And I knew enough of the language. But at that point, they had just evaluated me as if some stray dog had come in. And they were just sort of evaluating me and checking boxes on their forms. And then they said, okay, now we're going to take you to the hospital. And they brought out a wheelchair with restraints. And they put me in restraints because they said, I wasn't resisting or anything. I was very withdrawn and quiet. But they said that that's how they transport everyone in the when they transport them into the hospital, was in restraints. They put the wheelchair in the back of a dark van. And then I went to San Francisco General Hospital, the emergency psychiatric unit, which just tossed me in with a very crowded room, probably not much bigger than this, with people going through just all kinds of really extreme experiences, including street drug withdrawal and conflicts with the police and just all kinds of, it was a very, very nightmarish experience. And then that started, that event, that extremely traumatic event, started a whole process where I was in the public mental health system in San Francisco for about a year, including about 4 months in residential facilities, about 3 months in homeless shelters, and I guess about 2.5 months locked up at Langley Porter Psychiatric Institute. And so you see how I go into the system with one set of problems. And so now the system is giving me a whole other set of problems, a whole other layer of problems that I have to deal with, because it was very traumatic. And when I did come out of the emergency room and was in a residential unit, there was no one who was helping me to understand the trauma that I had just been through. It was validating that this had been a traumatic experience. It was as if none of it had happened. A number of things happened. And when I was at a residential facility, the place that I was at for 4 months, when I arrived there, there had been a suicide attempt right before I was there. And I talked to one of the people who knew the person who had killed himself. And I said, well, why was he was suicidal? He was depressed. What was going on? And she said, well, actually, the problem that he was having that led him to jump off of the building and die was that he was having very severe side effects from his medication, and people weren't talking to him about it or validating him about that. And this was more than 10 years ago, and I think things have gotten somewhat better about recognizing medication side effects. But that was one of the many, many things that I learned about this whole world kind of opened up to me. I had no idea that this is what the mental health system was about. And I should say that I have also had positive experiences with therapists, and I certainly have talked to people and know people and work with many people who have very positive experiences. Their hospitalization experiences are positive. Their medication, the psychiatric drugs that they use are helpful to them. So again, it's a diversity question, but for me it was a very traumatic thing. When I was an inpatient, there was a lot of testing that was done. They gave me an MRI, and they put you in the big sort of electromagnetic tube that takes photographs of your brain, and they did all these questions and quizzes and testing and stuff. And then a testing psychiatrist and two of the residents kind of met with me, and they did this very dramatic kind of moment where, okay, we've reached a conclusion about your diagnosis. You have a form of schizophrenia called schizoaffective disorder, and we recommend that you no longer be an activist and socially involved in environmentalism or anything else too stressful, and that medication is something that you're going to be using to manage symptoms for the rest of your life. So just that message that I now have essentially a broken brain, a broken body, my genes or my biochemistry or something, and then I'm this now outsider from humanity. I have to set aside all of my dreams, my hopes, the kind of normal trajectory that I had or hoped to have. Now I have to just completely lower everything. That in and of itself was a many, many years journey to get just beyond that. The medication piece, I tried a lot of different medications when I was in the hospital, in the system, and they really didn't help me. And still I started taking a neuroleptic called Novain. It's an older neuroleptic. And the way I can describe it for me, I mean, I know people who find psychiatric antipsychotics helpful, but for me, I really lost touch with my own personality. I really felt like I was a different person. And if you had asked me, people did, like, is this helping you? Do you want this medication? I'm like, yes, that was what I was holding on to as my kind of lifeline. And fortunately, I ran into, when I changed programs, I started to see a different doctor. And the doctor, for whatever reason, decided to take me off of this antipsychotic drug. And that was actually a very helpful thing, because I don't know where my life would have gone if I had stayed on that and stayed in that role. And so I was in the system for about a year, and at some point I really just started to feel exhausted, like I had exhausted what the system had to offer. In fact, one of the ironies that happened to me was that when I was, the last time that I was locked up, they had tried all these different things for me, and nothing was really helping. And they said, well, we've tried all these medications. We've tried lithium. We've tried antipsychotics. We've tried anti-anxiety drugs. So the really last thing that we have to try is electroshock therapy. And it's new now. It's different. But my father had electroshock, and he had electroshock in the 50s, and he was really harmed by it. He'd always cautioned me about it. And so I was very cautious. But they were giving me a lot of what they call patient education opportunities. They were giving me information and flyers, and they showed me a video. And so I was really struggling with this decision, because I really felt like there was no there was really nothing else that was being offered to me. And so I was, as I was struggling with this decision, now you have to understand that I was locked up, and I was told that I was too dangerous and too unable to take care of myself to leave, so they weren't going to let me leave the hospital. And as I was struggling with this decision about the electroshock, a social worker came in and she said, "Well, Mr. Hall, we're letting you go. We're discharging you tomorrow." And I said, "What? You're discharging me tomorrow?" And she said, "Yes, the insurance money has run out for your stay here, and we're discharging you tomorrow." So I was discharged, and I went to a homeless shelter on Mission and 14th in San Francisco, which is a very rough, rundown area. Actually, was at the time. I think things have gentrified and changed now in San Francisco, but it was really run down, dangerous place. There was a lot of drugs being dealt. It was like a voucher for a homeless shelter hotel. And my depression just totally lifted. I felt so much better being out of the system and being out of the hospital and being in that hotel and just being away from all of that. And I realized that was one of the things that they hadn't tried. They hadn't really tried freedom, hadn't tried giving me my own place to be and my own opportunity to get out of the hospital. So that experience and a number of other experiences, really, I just felt like the whole thing was played out. I had tried everything that they had to offer. And a friend of mine at that time was diagnosed with HIV. And this was sort of the very early time with looking at alternative therapies for HIV. And so my friend, instead of doing drugs and some other things, decides to do acupuncture and nutrition and look at their lifestyle and quit drugs and alcohol, all these different holistic perspectives. And I really started learning about that. And I started to put some things together, and I started to look at my diet, and I started to look at my lifestyle. And I started to think like, well, you know, actually I do feel better when I exercise. And I started to really make some connections, and actually went to a food allergist. And this was an MD, a Western medical doctor, food allergist. And they do this thing where they kind of draw a grid on your back, and they mark you with these little samples of different things that you might be allergic to. And so they did the test, and they told me that I was allergic to oranges, chocolate, and cow's milk. And when I was in the hospital, every single meal, the breakfast always had orange juice, and then the lunch and the dinner always had chocolate milk. I loved orange juice and chocolate milk, so I was. And then I asked the doctor, "Well, what are some of the symptoms of a side effect of symptoms of allergic reaction to, chocolate or milk, or that I might have?" And he listed all these different things, including confusion, fatigue, anxiety, depression, all these things that were contributing to. And this is not a holistic doctor so much. This is a Western medical specialist in allergy medicine. So I started to really put these things together. And, you know, I had been a political activist before I was in the system, and had always really thought for myself and had done a lot of research. And, I'm college educated. I have a lot of skills and ability to like investigate things. And so I really used all that on myself, really, as a liberation struggle for myself. Like, I'm in this crazy labyrinth. How do I get out of here? And I started to learn a lot of things the messages that I had got in the hospital weren't actually scientifically grounded messages, that there were all kinds of different explanations for what I was going through. And then I slowly started putting things back together. And I think I probably went a little bit too fast at one point. I probably started to feel better, and then I kind of went into something of a denial about parts of myself that I wasn't really looking at. And so I ended up in a school program that I left really horribly. I just totally flunked out of a school program. And then I was back in the in a residential facility for about 6 months. But that was in 99, and I haven't been in the system since then, and I haven't taken medication for about 13 years. And when I came out of that residential facility, I ended up in Northampton, Massachusetts. And I was looking around, because Northampton is, you know, it's a pretty progressive place. And I was looking around for some kind of holistic alternative place that had a recognition that sometimes people get traumatized in the system and helps people with their abuse experiences with psychiatry. And there really wasn't anything. And so, you know, being a political activist and feeling a little bit better, I decided, well, okay, let's try and start something. So I met another guy, Oryx Cohen, and he and I started the Freedom Center. And Oryx, he was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and he also had a very negative experience in the hospital. And his experience was just really intense. In fact, he was in such states, such extreme states, that he felt like he could contact kind of the quantum, he describes it in much better than I can, but he could contact the quantum physics reality of the universe. And as a result, he could make his car fly. So he flew his car right into a tree, and that's how he started into the mental health system. And he had the same experience that I did, that what the system offered just really made things worse for him. So we started with a library computer and a free email account, and we started having one meeting a month. And we just started putting the word out for people who had had bad experiences with the system or were looking for holistic alternatives to please just come to our support group. And that just slowly started growing. That was in 2000 that we started the Freedom Center. And today you can go to our website, which is freedom-center.org. And we have a weekly support group. We have a free acupuncture clinic that we set up that happens every Mondays. We have two and sometimes three free yoga classes weekly. We have art groups. We have writing groups. We actually are at the point now where we get some money from the city. The city actually does fund our work in some ways. So that was a really big success. And then through the Freedom Center, I was able to find out about this really interesting project called the Icarus Project, which we were like nickels and dimes, and the Icarus Project kind of had its act together, and they were able to get some foundation grants and things. And so that's how I ended up working with the Icarus Project. And so that's sort of like my story. And I think a lot of what I've been doing for the past 3 or 4 years is kind of taking my personal experience and trying to put it together with the research that we've been doing. Made a lot of contacts with the survivor movement and the activist movement internationally, especially in England, where it's very, very different. You turn on TV in the US and you see drug company advertising. They don't actually have that in most countries. It's only in the US and New Zealand that they have direct advertisements on TV where pharmaceutical companies are trying to sell you medications and asking you to go ask your doctor about this and why don't you try that. And so England, as a result, the psychological and psychiatric establishment in England is a lot less influenced by pharmaceutical company perspective. And so I started just discovering these amazing resources and these amazing studies and all this kind of stuff that was not really getting any play in the US media. And you have to understand that when we started doing this work in 2002 and 2003, the climate was really quite different than it is today. And I think that there's a much more of a skepticism towards psychiatric drugs now. There have been much more scandals with pharmaceutical companies. And people are really starting to catch on to holistic health and to alternatives and this kind of thing. But when we started doing this work, it was really very, very much new. And it still, for a lot of people, is very new. And we kind of started to boil down our perspective to really what are some of the main sorts of messages that we're trying to get across. And they come down to the philosophy that I think the Freedom Center has, and also the Icarus Project has, of three sort of principles. And one is self-determination. That's kind of where you start, that people who are considered normal, who are considered full members of society, are pretty much allowed to believe what they want to believe, to define themselves, to choose their lives, to really, you ask, if you want to know about them, you ask them. You don't ask someone who is charged with controlling them or representing them. So the self-determination piece is really, cool, thank you. The self-determination piece is really a big part about choice, about deciding for yourself what kind of treatment that you want, or what kind of therapist you want to go to, or you don't want to go to a therapist, or how you want to define yourself. Do you want to identify as having bipolar disorder? Do you not want to identify as having bipolar disorder? The self-determination piece and the choice piece is really, really central. But the thing about that part of it is that it doesn't really work if you don't have accurate information. So one of the things that we work really hard to do is to really explain to people some important pieces of the puzzle about their diagnosis, about the medications that they're taking, and about the experiences that they're going through. Basically, if you look at the scientific research, especially if you look at the kinds of studies and things that are coming out of England, like I mentioned before, and if you dig a little bit deeper into the mental health system in the U.S., you really will find that things that are really taken for granted, like, okay, mental illness is caused by a biological disorder. There is a genetic predisposition or a genetic cause to bipolar or to schizophrenia or these kinds of things. This really hasn't been proven scientifically. In fact, there's a lot of controversy about it. When you hear studies in the media, you will often hear them say there's a new theory or it's believed to be linked or there's a correlation. There's a lot of money that's going into the research, but there's no test that you can do. There's no scan that they can do of your brain. In fact, there's no real way for them to reliably distinguish between a so-called normal brain and a so-called mentally ill brain. There just hasn't been that kind of research. In fact, the idea that the brain is somehow causal, the biology of the brain is somehow causal of our experience, there's a biological blueprint, is actually being questioned by a lot of the studies that are coming out now. Like they're looking at studies where people who go through therapy, you can get a brain scan before you do therapy. You go through therapy, which is basically just talking and expressing yourself. And then after the therapy, they do a brain scan, and whoa, the brain has actually gone through some physical changes. So experience can change the brain, and the brain can be affected by things like trauma, for example. When I was in the hospital and they diagnosed me with schizophrenia, they never asked me about trauma in my childhood. They never asked me, my father is a Korean War veteran, my mother is a sexual abuse survivor. There's a lot of trauma in our family, and there was violence, emotional violence, and some physical violence that happened to me in my childhood. This was never a question in their interviews or discussion with me. It was all, okay, do you have any other mental illness in your family? Oh, there is. Okay, so there must be a genetic kind of thing. Well, I mean, child abuse also runs in families, and poverty runs in families. We don't consider these things to be physical or biological. So that's an important piece of the puzzle, is understanding that we've been told that there's a chemical imbalance, that there's serotonin deficiency, or there's some kind of biological causality. And these are theories that they've been searching very hard. If you could actually come up with a test that would reliably distinguish someone who has bipolar disorder, I mean, that's a multi-million dollar invention, and no one has ever been able to come up with that. In fact, many people who were in the system get multiple diagnoses over years. So they may get one diagnosis for a while, and then they change, and one doctor is more likely to give a schizophrenia diagnosis, another doctor kind of prefers bipolar, and one sort of feels like, well, depression, clinical depression with psychotic features, and it's a very fuzzy kind of thing. And so there's a real uncertainty there. Another piece of the informed consent and the information part of the principles that we work by is really understanding how medications work. And one of the things that I talk about is, and I have friends who use medication, helps them on a daily basis. That's great. I have friends who manage without medication. I have friends who smoke pot as a way of dealing with their bipolar diagnosis. I mean, if they don't have their marijuana, they're going to become manic. I mean, for me, if I smoke marijuana, I become manic. I mean, that's a totally different experience. But the idea is that it's a coping mechanism. So if some people use antipsychotics, some people take anti-anxiety drugs, other people go to therapy, other people may use cannabis, they may use holistic health. You wouldn't explain that by saying, oh, so-and-so has a marijuana deficiency disorder. That's why they have a THC imbalance in there. No, it's the drug that they're taking causes changes like drugs do. We know that drugs cause changes in consciousness in the mind, and people find that it's helpful. And there are risks. I mean, there are risks to smoking cannabis. There are risks to antipsychotic medication. There are risks to anti-anxiety drugs. So the idea is it's important to understand how the medications work and to not be in this mindset of, well, they work because someone needs it because of their biology and they just have to be on it and that's the end of the story, because that closes off options for people. And also it locks people in to what are potentially very dangerous treatments, because some of the side effects from these medications can be deadly. I mean, there was a study done where mental patients are shown to have a life expectancy of about 25 years shorter than the rest of society. And that's not from suicide or from poverty. That's from a lot of different factors, which largely the medication plays a big role in. So it's important to understand how the medications work so that choices can be made on accurate information. Another piece of this that's really important is people have also heard, you know, so-and-so went off their meds and then they had a crisis and this absolutely happens. I mean, I've seen this happen to people. They go off their medication and they have a crisis. And sometimes the image that we have is that the person has an illness and then the meds are kind of keeping the illness down. And then you take the medication away and the illness comes back. And that is true. I think that is true for some people. I think that's basically what's going on if they go off their meds and then they have a crisis. But at the same time, often the medication itself has a withdrawal effect. So if you are someone who drinks coffee every day and you suddenly don't have your coffee, you get a headache. Or if you're an alcoholic and you get delirium because you stop drinking alcohol or other kinds of addictions, this is exactly how a lot of the psychiatric medications work. If you stop taking them abruptly, you have withdrawal effects. One of the kinds of withdrawal effects that you can have is psychosis. So the medication can actually be causing experiences that people say, oh, they're off their meds, that's their mental illness coming back. So this is a very widely misunderstood part of the puzzle and something we're really trying to get people to understand. So after doing a lot of work with people for about 5 or 6 years, we kept coming up with this question of like, well, can I go off of my medication? How should I do it? You know, is it right for me to go off of my medication? And we always tell people, look, you know, you have to evaluate, is this medication helpful to you? Don't go in with an either or perspective, like I must be on the medication or all medication is bad. Go in with a question of, is this helpful to me? And look at a cost-benefit analysis, because there are trade-offs. There are negative parts to medication, there are positive parts to medication. So really take a look at it from that kind of perspective and understand that how is it that medication can be grappled with and how can it be how can you think about going off of it in a safe way? And so we came up with this guidebook, and I'm really proud of it, because it's been just years in the making, and there were 14 medical professionals, a lot of them from the UK, doctors, psychiatrists, nurses, some acupuncturists that are involved with it, and a lot of really good research that went into it. And one of the big messages is be careful going off all of a sudden, that's when the withdrawal effects can really get you. So taper off slowly and then learn how to put other things in place to help you cope, that maybe you have been using the medications and now you maybe need to think about other things, and also be open to a pathway that may lead places that you're not sure, that maybe you're convinced that you want to go off this medication, but actually you end up finding that it's best to just reduce the dosage for a while. Or maybe you try going off of it and then you think, well, actually, it's not the medication that I need help with, it's my housing situation, or really what I want to do is go back to school, and then maybe a few years down the line I can think about medication decisions. So we put this guide together. I just want to point this out to you. And one of the things that we did is that we made this a Creative Commons license. So it's free to download off of the Icarus Project and Freedom Center website. Yeah, sorry. There's a bunch of them over at the table. So I can pass this around. So, and they're $5, and you can also download it for free, and it's a common Creative Commons copyright. So you are free to print it out and photocopy it and hand it to as many people as you want to. You can put it on your website. That's the way we set it up, so that it would be easy to get distributed. So there's a lot more that I could say, and it's about 8 o'clock now. So what I'd like to do, thank you, you've been very patient and listening to, I have so much to talk about, so many things to say. So what we can do now is we can open it up to comments and questions, and if people have questions for me or for Jason or for Mouse or just have a comment or a thought, you can definitely, all that is welcome. So. Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much. This is just wonderful. My name is Lynn Nesbitt. I'm a therapist, and I work in a hospital setting in an intense outpatient care. And my frustration is talking with patients who are admitted to the program who won't do any of those things and sit back and simply ask for more medication. Like, the medicine is not the answer. Take my word for it. Not that it's not a tool that you can use. It's the only tool the medical establishment has to offer, but there are all of these difficulties and things like, you know, sleep and nutrition and creativity and expression and all of that are, when you balance it all out, so much more important than the medication is.
Yeah, I mean, it's an important question that raises a lot of, there's a lot in what you just said, and thank you for being here. It's great that there are people who are working on all different sides of the perspective, and I think that's one of the things that happens with the healing professions is that it's hard to get better when someone is telling you to get better. It can become like a power thing. So, you know, the education piece and the information piece and the choice piece are really important. But the other piece that I also want to mention is the idea of access. So is there an easy place for someone to go where they can get a decent meal? Is there an easy place for people to go where they can get free acupuncture, where they can get holistic health care from a naturopath, those kinds of things? And it raises a lot of social issues, and I think that's basically how we're going to be able to try and address mental health problems is from a larger perspective that is a lot about poverty. So a lot of it is often very much linked to poverty. So one of the things that we're doing as well is really just trying to respect people where they're at. I mean, if people are very much focused on medication as being the savior, then it's kind of understandable because that's the message that we're putting out as a society, and really kind of respect that's where the person is coming from. At the same time, create a whole range of opportunities for the person to explore at their own pace and in their own way about things. What is the agency that you work with? Well, thanks for. I'm just intrigued by your question. Maybe we can also. I put my email address up here. People want to talk to me individually or privately about specific things, or also if you want to get in touch with me after the forum tonight, because I like to be available, and it's something I do just on a regular basis. Is both like counseling peers, but also talking with mental health staff and trying to help people figure problem solve. So it sounds like you got some difficult kinds of problems that you're working on there. So yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, glad you're here, and I like the PA. It has some little bit of high end. Sometimes that's lacking. I get a feeling. My name's Ken Stockamp, just an interested individual who knows Cohen, your friend Oryx.
Oh, Oryx. Yeah.
That last started name is the Freedom Center. Yeah. Interesting history to that name. The providers. I get a feeling that they separate out the milieu. So that you got the agitateds who are a challenge, especially when you're on the floor as a patient with them to be in a different person's movie or yes or no, if you can run fast enough. But what happens after you're burned out? Is it the too far gone then who are the subjects for the electroshock when they want to reset their buffer, plug them into the wall? And what's it like to work with that milieu, which I have not yet seen?
Well, I mean, it's hard. I mean, the history of the mental health system is really in a lot of ways a history of despair, and a lot of people feel like they've just lost causes and people giving up and people, being forgotten. And I mean, I've met people who have been in the system 20 years, have spent years in lockup, and then have come out. And then live in the society and live free and start to take charge of their lives. And one of the things that, especially when you're faced with an overwhelming, seemingly overwhelming situation, one of the things that I often recommend to people is just to really always hold that attitude that you don't really know that it's hopeless, that there absolutely might be some way out here. And then to believe in that in the person and to look at every single person that you meet, no matter how far away they may be, and think this person may absolutely find their way to healing. They may absolutely completely recover, because the science can't predict, oh, sorry, you're always going to be schizophrenic. Oh, you're always going to be on that. They have absolutely no way of predicting who are going to be the people who stay in the system or who are going to be the people who, like me, are able to get out of it and move on. And so that would be the main thing that I would say to you. So thanks. Yeah.
Hey, Will.
Yes. Hey, how are you doing?
My name's John Hubbard. And I represent, if anyone, I guess, in this forum, I used to hang out here at the Process Work Center a little bit, so I'm a little bit familiar with process work and so forth. But tonight, I have a one of my sons has been diagnosed as bipolar and has had a number series of rather intense episodes, and I've been a lifelong advocate of liberation and self, you know, self-governance, self realization, and the very idea of locking someone up to me is disgusting. Yet when push came to shove, and when my son was clearly a danger to himself by running through traffic, hanging out of windows in a precarious kind of way, you know, several stories, and where, you know, I have a relationship with my son, yet that was clearly shut down, and it didn't much matter what I said to him when he was in this intense state. And I know the standard criteria in the mental health system is, if you're a danger to yourself or others, then that's sort of where the bottom line, that, you know, then you when you get locked up. And I was hoping you could talk a little bit about that place where, I don't know if you're getting where I'm going with it, but I mean, just that as much as I want everyone to be able to make their own decisions, especially people that I really love and that I'm connected to, that they're, is also at some point a place for that, and I'm kind of playing devil's advocate.
You put your finger on. I mean, this is a dilemma that so many of us are in, is that it's kind of like it's like an all or nothing approach. It's either what do we do or lock them up in the hospital. And what we really need are intermediary kinds of ways of responding to crisis. There's so much in what you're saying, and it's such a painful thing to think about. One of the things that's hard is that often parents, it's like the parent is trying to offer the help, but it's tied to the parent. So that I don't want that help because you're offering me the parent. And so there's a family systems part of this. And so it's very difficult sometimes for families to be the supporters and to be the helpers in a situation like that. It's often, you know, getting outside of the family entirely is really important. But then, who is there? What services are there? There are no services. So one of the reasons that the criminal justice system is swelling with people who have extreme states of consciousness, who have psychiatric labels, is there are no other voluntary services. One of the reasons that I wrote my blog down here, this is theicarusproject.net/blog/will, is there's an incredible program in Toronto, Canada, called the Family Outreach and Response Program. And they work with people exactly who are going through what you're going through. And they have survivors on the staff as well as professionals. And they have very strong principles of self-determination. That's their goal. That's their basic, their bottom line. And they deal with situations where there are no other options. And so force is something that gets used, but I would love to see more programs like FOR in the United States. And I mentioned this to you because you might want to get in touch with them, and they could give you some ideas. Another part of it is that in the equation of, okay, this person needs safety, let's get them into the hospital, part of that equation is that, well, the hospital may also be a source of danger. So one of the things that we do when people do end up in the hospital is we try and really keep a close watch on that person, because it's not, okay, they're in the hospital now, let's let the doctors kind of take care of it, because it's not like that. And then another part of what you're presenting is the whole question of dangerousness itself, because to a parent, maybe something looks dangerous, but to a rock climbing buddy, just climbing on a window is not going to be a dangerous kind of thing. So there's a subjectivity that's involved that we often don't really recognize, that the context is going to be really important. Someone who seems like they are really not able to take care of themselves and they're going to be running out in the streets in one context, if you put them in a different setting, maybe if they're away from their family or they have different kinds of support or certain kinds of people around them, they may settle down. It may be a context kind of related thing. But it's absolutely true that the dilemmas that you are talking about, people are facing all the time. There's no simple answer to it except to continue to put forward what our values are and to say, look, we need better services. We need true alternatives. We need ways for people to move forward without the risk of being traumatized in a hospital, or without only having forced hospitalization to be the answer, to have therapy and support available for families that are in distress, to learn from programs like what's going on in Toronto. So, but yeah, let's talk more about this, because I know a little bit more about your situation, so we can talk more about it. So, other in the back, yeah.
Hi there. Thank you. Well, this is a topic that I feel really passionate about, and I appreciate your discussion. My name is Krista Tricarico, and I'm a naturopath, and I do holistic mental health. My question right now, I do private practice, and my question is about accessibility and suggestions you might have for getting into the system and finding ways to be more accessible, whether it's community mental health or what the openings are.
What do you mean in terms of being able to provide your services for
bringing alternatives into the mainstream medicine? Right now, it's quite a privilege to be able to afford somebody in private practice and see somebody outside. And when
it's such a class issue. It's a serious class issue, and that's something that's not talked about enough. And that's one of the reasons that all the services that we provide at the Freedom Center are free. And we always have made that a really important. I made sure that the event tonight was going to be free because it's an important part of this work. Let me maybe just tell you the story of how we got our acupuncture clinic started. There's a acupuncture protocol, because when we think of acupuncture, we think of one person, an acupuncturist meeting with a client, spending a lot of time with them one-on-one. But there's a protocol that's an ear acupuncture protocol called NADA, and Jason actually knows a little bit about this, and it was set up to help people in drug detox, but it's since expanded beyond that because acupuncture is so powerful. Even just ear acupuncture is so powerful, and we found it to be really helpful with, for example, helping people get to sleep, because sleeplessness can be a dramatic factor in causing people going into crisis. And so getting to someone to rest is a huge, huge thing that you can do. So the ear acupuncture protocol is something you can do with like 30 people in a room with one acupuncturist going around. And so we were able to raise a little bit of money, and but it was only like $40 a session. And then we can treat like 35 people once a week. And we've had this clinic going now for, I guess almost 3 years. And then I'm trained in doing this protocol, and I demonstrated it in Anchorage, Alaska. And now they have the same thing going on in Anchorage, Alaska. So I think if you start to think creatively about how to do this and how to provide free services, or there's a lot of practitioners out there that I think if you call them and said, hey, would you do one free session a week to a group of five people just as part of like a pro bono volunteer? I bet a lot of practitioners would be willing to do that. So I think there's ways that you can think about kind of going, swimming against the tide and making that happen. And then, I mean, the other thing we need to do is absolutely just educate the established system and just say, look, the nutrition issues are really important here. And, why not have an acupuncturist as well as, a medication clinic? And why not give people the options of trying things first? One of the things that I recommend to everybody who's a professional and trying to think about these issues is to really try and find other people to connect with, like find another professional naturopath or holistic doctor or something who shares your values so that you don't feel isolated, so that it doesn't kind of come up and like it's a cool idea and then you sort of forget about it. But you can really kind of make it the foundation of your value system. Like, how am I going to get out of the class privilege of the market that I'm serving, and how can I get it to other people? One of the things that I can help do, because I know Jason and the Icarus folks, and I'm starting to know a little bit about the Portland mental health scene, is if you contact me, I can try and make some connections happen and see what would happen. I know that in Northampton, we started offering our free acupuncture clinic, and then the mainstream system, some of their clients started coming. And then we said, well, why don't we send our acupuncturist over to your clinic, your residential facility? And then they started going over every now and then. And then that caught on. And now the mainstream system in Northampton is offering acupuncture for its clinic. So
that's what I'm kind of interested in, finding out the ends, the little bit of openings, because Portland is on the cusp, I think, of including holistic medicine in the mental health realm. And many places in the country are not. And just wanting that perspective of like, oh, this organization might have a little bit of a, you know, opening, and just continuing that conversation so we can bring our medicine to more people. Because there's so many ways, so many options out there, and people that aren't exposed to
them. Definitely. Definitely. Other questions? Yeah.
You might mention, I was just thinking of Outside In and the Old Town Clinic.
I'm just thinking of Outside In and the Old Town Clinic as places that are looking at treatment from, I think, a broader perspective that doesn't have economics as such a strong barrier.
Sounds like there's some organizing happening right here, which is really what we want to happen. So,
My name is Sandy Wilson. I'm a consumer. And I had a couple things I want to say. One of them is that clozapine probably saved my life. It got me out of the depths of all kinds of symptoms and crazy things like that. And taking it was a different experience for me than what most people experience with that. But I quit taking it in favor of some of the newer psychotropic drugs that don't have the sedating side effects and all that other stuff. And I went from this world where I took meds 8 times a day and somebody told me what to do, and I spent 6.5 years in Multnomah County on a trial visit because I couldn't get it together. And when you're taking a medication for this, for that, and for the other thing, and for the side effect of this, that, and the other thing, you don't get anywhere, or I didn't. And I mean, I'd have these huge med boxes. It was horrible for me, but I didn't know any other way to live. And I've been with the same community service since 1994. And I went from going every day to where I don't go when I want to now, you know. And a lot of it has to do with, I've been through lots of practitioners, because in the community, the system changes a lot. Your therapist goes away, your doctor goes away, you know, they come back, they go away again. They send you to this hospital and that hospital, and they keep you. And I need to say that not all my experience in Portland in the hospital has been bad. Some of it was really, really helpful. And some was really, really damaging. So it's really helpful to me to sit in a room and have somebody say, you know, you can be a victim of the system. I happen to be in a 12-step program, and my sponsor says to me, you know, you are an institutionalized person. You've been institutionalized forever and ever and ever. And I've been medicated since I was 9 years old, and I'm 47 years old, okay? My reality has been a lot of hospitals and a lot of residential treatment and that kind of thing. In this process, somewhere in the last several years, I kind of woke up. I kind of just wandered through the world and let everybody do whatever they wanted to. And what feels really affirming to me today is to be able to say, I tell the doctor what I'm willing to take and what I'm not willing to take, and when I'm willing to go to therapy and when I don't want to go to therapy. Why am I paying these people when I don't have anything I want to work on? You know, why are they getting money from this insurance company because they think I need to talk to them when I don't have anything I want to say? You know, and I finally have the idea, and I think that this is the part that's important to me, the affirming part, and it comes from myself, people who I talk to, and from the people in the system that I work with, that I am not a diagnosis. I'm a person first, you know, and it took me many, many years to get past, oh, there's Sandy and she's schizoaffective and just leave her in that corner to be psychotic, you know, because I'm not psychotic today. It's been a long time since I was psychotic, and I'm really grateful for that. But then, you know, then you hear about people who never get out of the hospital, you know, and they told my parents at one point, just leave her there. You know, just leave her there because it's not going to get any better.
Really happy you know? That you're here today.
So I'm just saying, you know, the thought of not taking any meds is scary to me, but it's affirming. And I'm just going to do what I'm doing right now because it works, you know, and life is good for me, you know. And so I think that somewhere there's a balance, you know, inpatient services, outpatient services, no services. You know, I think the thing that I find disheartening in Oregon is the cut in services. You know, I mean, I've been here 22 years, almost 23 years, and I've been in the system almost the whole time I've been here. And you went from an abundance of beds for people who really need them. They'd stick people in there who didn't even get the beds full, I think. And now, unfortunately, I really believe that some people need to be in the hospital sometimes. That's my personal belief. Because if there hadn't been hospitals, I probably wouldn't be here, you know. So,
and often people end up in prisons and jails.
Yeah, because they need to be in the hospital. You know, so, I mean, I think it's real important, and I think the Icarus project, I think all that stuff's really important and really vital, and I am so glad somebody told me that this was happening tonight. So thanks for being here.
Thanks a lot for coming. Yeah. Wow, thank you. That's very touching. And congratulations on your process. It's really touching to hear that. So, other question in the back.
And I have been a consumer / survivor, is what they call them out here. And I've worked in the mental health system, so I've seen it from both ends. And the system here is broke. I think it needs to be totally revamped. But at the same time, I think it's broke in different ways, not just they're doing things to people they shouldn't do. They're not doing the things that they need to be
doing.
And I just had a friend just about about a month ago died from anorexia. She was 70 pounds, and they didn't keep her in the hospital. They let her do her own program, which was, I want to do it my way, forget what the doctor says. She didn't even know she was dying. She had no idea that she was going to die, and she was 70 pounds. She looked like a walking skeleton, and they wouldn't put her in the hospital. So I've seen kind of both sides where, and the mental health system out here, I've seen a lot of waste, I've seen fraud, I've seen all kinds of stuff going on, and it is broke beyond repair. It needs to be totally revamped. I also think that I appreciate where you're coming from, where you say, you know, a holistic approach and all that. That's great. However, at the same time, we need to be careful not to take a step back when in time where it was only your behaviors and only your lifestyle that was causing your mental illness. And that it was you were judged for it. So I really think we need to be careful about that and validate that there are genetic reasons. There could be other things besides your lifestyle, you know.
I think it's a really important point that you raised. Thanks. I think that's one of the reasons that we went so strongly to the biology and the genes and this is the cause of it, it's an illness, is because it feels like either it's biological, it's genetic, or it's completely my choice and it's my responsibility and I'm lazy. And then there's something missing in this perspective. And one of the things that I think about a lot is trauma, that so many of the people who I work with, and I know in my own experience, who end up with extreme experiences, end up with mental health labels, have been through some kind of trauma. Now, is trauma your fault, or is it your genes or your biology? Well, it's somewhere in between here. It's an overwhelming injury that happened to the person. So I think that that's absolutely where we've come from. We've come from this swing, I think, in the 60s and 70s. It was all like, oh, it's bad mothering, it's your parents, and that's the problem, to it's all genes, it's all disease, it's all illness, it's the brain. And then now somewhere we're trying to find where the truth is, which is somewhere that's not either one of those. So, thanks for your thoughts. So, Joe, yeah.
Thanks so much for doing this, Will. This is like a feast. And when you were talking, I thought I had a radical thought. Maybe even looking for any causes at all is maybe not that productive.
Interesting.
In other words, I always get irritated when people say it's either lifestyle or it's the way you were brought up or it was trauma or it's your genes. It's got to be one of those things. Maybe it's just that diversity, experiential diversity or behavioral diversity, makes us look for causes rather than saying this is one's path in life. Mm. And how are we going to deal with diversity in mm-hmm. our life paths?
Yeah, I like what you're saying. And I think one thing that it comes back to the self-determination thing. It's like one person is going to have one choice and explanation for who they are and how they are in the world. Another person is going to have something different. One of the approaches that I take is not like, well, what caused this, but what is useful to you? Is it useful to you to pursue this path where medication is the thing that you're focusing on? If that's useful for you, then great. For me, I have found for a while that focusing on trauma was extremely useful to me. It's like, wow, it makes sense that I do this because this happened with my father and this happened with my childhood. Now that's not so useful to me. So I've moved on to some different things. I look at spiritual factors and I look at the question of just my diversity as a person. This is my part of my uniqueness as in terms of my creativity or my sensitivity, my just being sensitive. Like, well, why are some people sensitive and others aren't? Well, maybe it's genetic, maybe it could be all kinds of things. So I like what you're saying. For me, it just comes back to the idea of really focusing on the individual and thinking about what's empowering for them, what's helpful for them in that personal process and decision that they're making. So just something you want to say? Okay. Yeah.
It's on. Hi, my name is Stephanie, and I work in the mental health field here in Portland, and my mom is severe mental health issues. The question that I keep wanting to ask, and I don't know, it's kind of personal. Is that okay if I...
If you want to, I mean, you could also, I'd be happy to talk with you privately if you prefer that, but if you want to share it, you're welcome to, or if you need to...
Well, it goes into some of what you're talking about, your personal history, so I don't know. It's.
Oh, you have a question for me about my personal. Oh, yeah. Ask away. I'll tell you if I don't like the question.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
Let's go
so,
for it.
I'm curious about how you speak to yourself about mental health issues, and do you anticipate experiencing moments of despair that were so great that you felt suicidal again?
I schedule them
life?
Actually. I plan on a certain day I'm going to be depressed, and then Thursday is anxiety day, Wednesday is despair day, Saturday's mania day, and so. It's an interesting question. Let me try and answer it. I mean, one of the tools that I work with that I think is helpful, but I also think it's kind of a crude sort of tool, is the idea of early warning signs. That I know that if I start to miss some sleep and I start to skip some meals and I haven't really left the house, I'm kind of headed somewhere that I don't necessarily want to be. And so I learn how to look at my early warning signs. And I have my friends also know, hey, I haven't heard from Will in a while. What's up with him? I think I'll give him a call. Or, hey, Will, when was the last time you had a square meal? Those kinds of things are important. And I say that it's a crude tool because sometimes I need to do those things. Sometimes I need to not eat and not sleep and stay in my apartment because I'm dealing with something. I mean, I'm a writer, and sometimes those are very creative moments, are those moments of darkness and despair. And so I think it's important to not make it overly simplistic. But personally, I have a lot of, I'm not sure exactly where you're, what's the most interesting part of your question for me, but I have a lot of forgiveness for myself. There's times when I'm just offline, like I just can't, I can't go out of my room and I can't pick up the phone. I know that my friends are there. One of the big lessons that I learned just in the past 2 years was when I'm in those really dark, and these are called, like in schizophrenia, they're called negative symptoms. You just get really withdrawn and you're just like, oh, what is showering? Does that make sense? You just aren't interested in the simple things that people take for granted. One of the things that really has helped me in the past 2 years is I learned that I could call my friend and I could just say, hello, it's Will. I'm going through something. I don't really know what to say. Goodbye. And it seems like nothing has happened, but it's actually really important just to make that kind of human connection. But yeah, I mean, I have a lot of, through the Icarus Project and the Freedom Center, I have a lot of people who I've just talked with over the years. And so I can talk with them and I can call them and I can connect with them or I can go hang out with them. And then they can pick up where I am and they know. And that's been really, really crucial. I mean, I talk about the food allergies and the exercise and yoga and stuff, but the connections with people has been really important for me. Also, I think process work has been helpful. I learned that the hospital wanted to kind of split me in two, like this is the normal healthy Will, and this is kind of the bad diseased Will, and you want to have less of this and more of this. And actually, I found out that if you try and make the diseased unhealthy part goes down, it doesn't like it, and it kind of goes even higher, and you sort of become like your own internal judge. You're like, oh, I'm bad because I didn't take care of myself today, or I'm hearing voices today, and I must have done something wrong. I must be failing in my program or my therapy. And one of the things that process work has taught me, and I think it's like an age-old wisdom, is that sometimes the places that are the most painful and the darkest and the most mysterious, you know, we turn away from them. But if you actually go into them and if you look at them and see what's there, they actually might offer something positive that you need. And just to give you a real simple example, like I have a lot of what's called paranoia. Like I think people are thinking about me, and I'll see a little hand gesture and I'll think that the person wants to kill me or something, or they offer me food and I think it's poison, or they must be trying to trick me or something. And I learned through using process work techniques that actually, instead of going away from people, I need to go closer to people. And those, what are you doing with your hand? Are you hurting me? It's cool that my housemate is here, because I use some of these tools with her, is actually using those moments of real fear as a place to connect with other people. And I also noticed that in my states that would be called depression, those are really sensitive states, and I love the sensitivity that I get when I'm in one of those places, because I can just feel sadness, and I can feel, and it's almost like it's an antidote for the other parts of me where sometimes I'm just kind of racing along and bicycling and doing a bunch of projects, and I'm just like outgoing, and that kind of gets kind of shallow sometimes. So I think, I don't know if I'm quite answering your question, but for me, like holding my so-called negative states and not seeing myself as pathological or diseased, but seeing myself as a whole person where the downside helps the upside, and they're all kind of part of this whole thing, has been really important to me. So,
hi, my name is Mary.
Hi.
And we'll go for full disclosure here. I'm here at the suggestion of my mother's physician, who is an alternative care provider here in Portland and naturopath, Greg Garcia. She's 81, and she had I'm going to call it a psychotic break because I'm new to the education of what this is, what this mental illness is. About 20 years ago, she described kind of a shamanic experience of, you know, like a kundalini opening, and received all this grandiose information about being from another planet and here to save the world. And it's caused her to live with some paranoia and a very isolated existence, and she has no insight into her illness to this day. My question is about, is there some path that I can take to learn about how to help her gain insight?
Great question.
She has had one experience with an antipsychotic medication that actually made her present as though the mother that I knew, you know, 20 years ago prior to the psychotic break. And then has refused medication ever since. She's non-compliant, and so we've gone to alternative care to see if she's more comfortable there and see what it can offer. But his what he's come to is that she actually does need to progress into some antipsychotic medication to help her to come out of this existence that she has, which is very painful to watch because she's very isolated and she's paranoid and she's obsessive compulsive, and it's just, and well, she's abusing substance abuse too.
It's a really important question that you bring up. And again, I'm happy to try and be available to you personally. My email is up there and talk. I can't really say much about it because you're describing something that's pretty general. I don't have any experience with this person directly. But often the idea of insight and someone having insight or not having insight is about a conflict. There's some conflict that's going on that one side wants one thing and the other side is like, no, I don't agree with that. I don't think that I have an illness. And it may be that what your goal is for her to be happier or healthy or involved or connected may be completely compatible with these shamanic, grandiose spiritual ideas. In fact, somehow connecting the two, right now they're in opposition. It's like either she's into her grandiose shamanic ideas or she's, you know, functioning back in reality. And we've got to convince her that she's diseased and she's ill and she has to get rid of all these ideas and somehow reversing that sort of equation so that there's some validation for these states that she's been in. Now, I mean, it's like trying to work on a problem that's totally removed. There's no way to really deal with the details, because really the details are going to show what might be helpful there. But this is one of the reasons that I mentioned the Family Outreach and Response Program, and also one of the reasons that I'm involved with the Process Work School, because I bet you that there are a number of different approaches that maybe haven't been brought in terms of like family therapy, for example, or trying to look at it from a spiritual perspective or using process work. I know some of the people here do family therapy with process work. So I think I don't know how helpful that is as a suggestion, but I'd be happy to talk with you more about it. But it's a complicated situation because it does become a power struggle, and one side wants one thing and the other side doesn't. And I mean, I think that, like I said before, often receiving help is very difficult when it's coming from a family member. And I think that maybe one of the things that if you have someone in your life that you want to change and you can't seem to get through to them, it's sometimes helpful to try and work on the things that you can change, like things in yourself or with the other family members. Families exist in fields and systems, and so maybe if you change parts over here, it could affect parts over there. And then also, if I have a situation that is like someone's presenting to me like, look, there's no way out. There's like, this is just a puzzle that can't be solved. We've tried everything. Again, I just come back to this idea of connecting with the unknown, that you don't know where the person is going to. It may be that tomorrow she's discovered something and something is different. And to be holding out that place in yourself and really cultivating that sense of possibility that there could be some way of something unexpected or some new opportunity that would arise. So I don't know if that's helpful, but I'd be happy to talk with you more about maybe trying to connect you with some other resources or something like that. So other, yeah, hi.
Yeah, my name is Jeremy. I am connecting with a couple of questions past. I had the privilege of growing up in rural Zambia, and in many of the villages, most of them probably, there are people whose behavior is way beyond normal, and the society there very easily accommodates that, and in fact welcomes it. They're all given the value of Sangoma, they are called teachers or healers or something. And I'm just wondering, in a city, obviously, it's a totally different situation, but is there any sense in which, in the long term, it's feasible even to dream of educating enough people around in society, maybe everybody, to accommodate people who are different, marginalized, so that we don't have to institutionalize or provide specialized services, but rather welcome?
That's a great question. I think that there's a lot to be learned from traditional cultures and different ways of viewing madness and viewing difference. A lot of the people that I work with and a lot of the experience that I had, I mean, if I had had a place to go where I didn't have to work and I could just kind of hang out and someone would bring me food, I could have avoided a lot of the experiences that I got into with the mental health system. And a lot of times it's just someone, you have a choice between like supporting yourself and working and showing up as a normal functioning person in society, or you're just like, you're just broken and that's it. And there's nowhere for you to go. We don't have extended family structures where people can just kind of be around and be fed and just sort of taken care of when they're not up to the same level of activity or functioning that other members of the family have or members of the community have. So like questions like yours, I think really raise the question that I think comes to this idea of diverse ability, and that our society is getting just more and more narrow in terms of what is considered acceptable and what is considered normal, and you have to pretty much carry your own weight. And there's historically societies aren't like that, where everyone is just going off and fending for themselves, and there's much more space, there's physical space where people can stay, there's caretaking that happens, there's kitchens and there's cooking and there's people around who have time and have energy and have just this sort of heart and resources. And our society is becoming much, those spaces are shrinking more and more and more, and as a result, if there's less freedom and space for people to just start to just drop out and go into their spiritual weird opportunity. But I would love to see an acknowledgement that that's a valid kind of career path and some space made for that. But I think it ties into larger issues of economics and poverty and what's happening with families and the overwork situation in the U.S. So, but thanks for mentioning that. So, yeah, who was next? Or yeah.
Oh, I was just going to ask you, getting back to her question, when you were talking about the experiencing the negative symptoms, and then that bringing you to experience the up symptoms or the, you know,
I don't know if I explained that really very well, but yeah.
But do you ever get fearful that you're going to stay in the negative symptoms, and what causes you to make that full circle?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, I think there's a learning process that's happened, that because I do still go down into states where I'm absolutely convinced that not only will I always be there, but I've always been there, and the rest of my life was just like a fantasy that wasn't really that. That's kind of what you have that one too. Yeah. I have a little bit right now, but there's a little of the high dream is there now too. So, you know, sometimes. It's almost like you go down and then you go up, and then each time you're learning something, you have more experience. So just the process of going through it and going through it can itself reinforce the fact that, well, you go through it. There's things that I've learned at the bottom that I really learned that I need to not do. Like there's some kinds of foods that I just need. I can't drink alcohol or start drinking lattes to get to jack myself up. I can't do recreational drugs. And those are things that I've learned the hard way. And it means that my downs are not as low and I come out of them a little bit quicker. And sometimes having people around you who can be like, actually, we've got a really nice square meal for you, so you don't just binge on ice cream all day, or you just like, you know, drink beer or something like that. You've got people, a supportive environment that helps you to remember the kinds of things that you need to remember that help you to not be down there. I mean, having other people who've also been in those states that I can contact. And also one of the things I'm doing is I'm educating people. Like my friends know to not, if they say, hey, Will, how are you doing today? I'm like, I just feel really bad. They know to not say, oh, really? Why? Because for some reason, when I hear that, I either freeze or I want to like scream. And I don't quite understand why that is, but I just know that doesn't work for me. And so I've educated them to tell them, here's what to say. Like I have a map. I mean, in the Freedom Center and the Icarus Project, we talk about developing mad maps. You go down, you come out of it, you think, hey, what happened? This is what helped me. This did not help me. You write it down and you give it to your friend. And then the next time that you go down, So they won't say, oh, really? You're feeling bad? Why? Because that's terrible for me. They'll say, which is what I like to hear, which is, so what's what do you mean? What's, tell me more about that. What's going on? You know, more like a therapy, like an open-ended therapy kind of question. Like, well, what is going on at the moment? Not why or what happened, but what's it like down there? That's what's helpful. And then also, I also instruct them to like give me a long time to be silent. Like sometimes they will ask me that, and I'll be down, and I'll be like, and it looks like I'm just calm or quiet, but actually I've got so much going on in my head. And then maybe like three minutes is a long time to wait for a response, and then I'll be able to talk to them. So I've also instructed people to be really patient with me. So things like that, and they're very different for every person, but the idea of creating a mad map and educating the people around you to support you can help you when you go down to have it not quite be as far, and then you come out of it, and then you also maybe have a little bit more insight about something positive about it, or you come out of it faster, or it becomes useful, or when you get out of it, you know how to prepare for it next time a little better, that kind of thing. So, other questions?
My name is Matt Davis. I write for a newspaper in Portland called the Portland Mercury.
Oh, cool.
I was thinking a lot while you were talking, and I was going around in my head, and I had loads of thoughts, but there were a couple of things that really struck a chord with me. The thing you said about society possibly being a little crazy, I think really hit home. And also the thing you said about using your, when you're down, like thinking of that as a positive and looking at some of those sensitivities that you experience when you're depressed. And I thought that was really helpful. I started having panic attacks about 6 or 7 months after I came to this country, and I didn't really know whether that was to do with me or whether it was to do with the society or whether it was to do with working for a newspaper. Probably all of them. But in England, you'd mentioned the England system is very different, and in England is everyone drinks to kind of get over any kind of social anxiety. You just have a few drinks, whereas here it's very much frowned upon. And I realized pretty soon after coming here that some of the issues that I'd been kind of self-medicating for in England were not going to be able to self-medicate for here. And I started getting into the mental health system, and they gave me drugs, and I started, you know, taking these drugs. And I don't know whether I'm better now or when I first arrived. I mean, honestly, and hearing a lot of what you said has been really interesting to me. It's started me thinking about a lot of the stuff. Going back to working for the newspaper, we cover a lot of celebrity gossip. And something that really struck me when Britney Spears started having all these issues, and that was the question that was coming to, was about what you thought of what was going on with Britney.
What do I think of Britney Spears?
Yeah. But the reason I was going to ask...
She's a basketball player,
she's
right?
She's a basketball player. The reason I was going to ask you is, you know, where I work, everybody is talking about Britney and this, oh, she's a train wreck, or she's this, or she's that, she's her. And I was looking at her thinking, well, no, she's just actually a victim of the industry, the media industry or whatever, and the industry that I'm part of. And to see people thinking of her as a train wreck, for me, just coming over here and being diagnosed with something I'd never had before was like, whoa, really interesting to look at the societal aspects of what you've been talking about. So I guess I was kind of interested in if you'd been following that, if you had any thoughts on how that was a teaching opportunity for people with mental illness or for society at large, or if it was just something you don't care about.
I think I'm in the, I'm ashamed to say that I don't care about Britney Spears, but actually, I mean, I think it's actually interesting because, I mean, it is kind of like a national dialogue. We use the popular culture as a way of creating a national dialogue about these issues among people, and so it is kind of happening. I don't know that much about what has been going on. I know that what you said really raises a lot of the ideas of what the Icarus Project is about. Do people know the myth of Icarus? Icarus is a boy who is trapped in a labyrinth with his father, who actually constructed a labyrinth, and his father's an inventor, and so he invents wings out of feathers and wax, and they use it to escape the labyrinth. It's on an island. And the father says to Icarus, okay, just be careful. Don't fly too low because you'll drown in the ocean, and don't fly too high because you'll get up by the sun and the wax will melt and the feathers will fall apart and you'll won't be able to fly. And so Icarus just is so excited about flying that he just gets too close to the sun and then goes right into the ocean. And so it's a myth that we picked up for the Icarus Project because for a number of reasons. One is that who wouldn't want to fly? And flying is the most awesome thing. And so there's an element to, I mean, when I'm sensitive or I connect with psychic realities or I have paranormal experiences or I'm creative or I feel inspired, I mean, these are part of my madness in a sense, but these are really gifts. These are really positive things. But they're not just gifts, they're dangerous gifts. If they're used incorrectly, if I don't care for them, if I'm not careful, I'm going to get into trouble. And the way to learn how to navigate so that I'm not too high, and also I don't want to go too low. I don't want to just be like keep it all under control and never go a little nuts sometimes and never stay up all night and never be creative. And I want to be somewhere, you know, flying, but not too high, not too low. The way is to be able to learn a little bit from the mainstream, that the messages of the system is totally wrong. Let's create a whole new thing based on our spiritual, cosmic, visionary ideas. That's great, but actually the system does have some good messages for us too, which is that, well, actually you ought to think about eating good food and taking care of yourself, and you know, maybe medication might not be so bad for some people. And so there's a voice of kind of like the mainstream that's sort of trying to be put into this mix of helping this boy learn how to use his wings. And so part of the not flying too close to the water means not giving up all those visionary ideas. I mean, I think that our society that we live in is really on a collision course with ecological destruction, and we're poisoning ourselves. I mean, there's so many things that need to just change. The overwork, the fact that there's no space for people to drop out, the fact that we're working so much that we can't take care of ourselves. What's happening with our elders that just get dumped in nursing homes? Just society is really crazy in a lot of ways. The amount of money that just gets spent on the Iraq war, let's have a huge war, let's spend hundreds of trillions of dollars, just let's just do it, whereas these other social problems, we don't really have the money to take care of those things. It's really a crazy society. And so when you're in those visionary states, you contact, like, let's create a revolution, let's do something different. And I think that there's a positive quality of that we don't want to lose and we don't want to forget. And that's really a message that's really different than the mental health system, and it's really also really different than mainstream society. And that's why we need things like the Icarus Project, so people can come together and kind of be true to what those inner experiences are, and not just try and conform and fit in and be normal. Now, how this fits back to Britney Spears, I'm not quite sure I can wrap it all up, but it actually, I think it comes in some ways to the idea of insight, like the people around Britney or this person, this media person, Britney, are concerned about her. She's not listening. She's going off and doing all these things. What do we do? And then really there's only one option in society, which is, you know, toss her in a psych hospital. And that's really where we need to have a discussion as a society of what intermediary kinds of places can we set up that are voluntary, that help people in a supportive way. But I have to say, like, if I had paparazzi following me around all the time, I would probably go totally nuts myself. So does that kind of answer your question a little bit? Maybe not. So yeah.
My name is Amelia. I am a survivor consumer. I'm also an activist and organizer in the immigrants' rights community.
Oh, great.
And so for me, being a political activist, I see things on a level of systems. As I've come to address my illness and thinking about it, I've come to see how, like, patriarchy has played out in my life, and how being a woman and coming from a specific class has really played a huge role in my mental state and who I am and how I deal with that. And so I'm kind of interested in how the Icarus Project, how you balance that, how you balance. So for me, like, being an activist, I'm, like, on the streets a lot, but I also, like, need, you know, the support. And it's interesting because I've been able to bring this up in the, like, activist community that I'm in, that, like, hey, we need to figure out ways to support people where they're at and really think about, like, care and, you know, how do we support people, because there's like a real culture of like, you know, you're going, and then when somebody drops out, people are like, oh, they're just lazy or whatever. And it's like, no, maybe they're actually going through something, there's a trauma, you know. And so I'm wondering how you guys balance looking at the broader system and seeing that there are all of these kinds of oppressions that play out around race and around women and class and sexuality that really impact our mental health, and how you do that work, but then also how you, you know, interface that with a personal level and in the communities that you're in.
Yeah, I really love what you're saying. I mean, this has been one of the big pushes that a lot of us in the Icarus Project have been doing, is trying to get a lot of activist communities to think about mental health and wellness, because so many of us do come from activist backgrounds. I mean, I was very much involved in the environmental movement and the anti-apartheid movement, the anti-war movement, before I had this big crisis and then went in and ended up in the system. And it was absolutely what you're saying, that there's kind of like people are often driven by guilt and a sense of personal responsibility and a personal sacrifice. And a lot of the workaholic mentality comes into social service and activism and trying to save the world and all this kind of stuff. And ultimately, it just means that people burn out and leave. And so the ways in which all these different forces play into the personal level, and then trying to understand where you fit into that, and then how to balance your wellness with actually being effective in the world, is a really important part of it. I don't have a simple answer, but one of the things that I should say about the Icarus Project is a big part of what we do is there's a huge website forum. And so there are about, I think, more than 4,000 people registered, and there are just thousands and thousands and thousands of threads of discussions. And it's absolutely everything that you can think of, everything that we've talked on here, all kinds of diverse experiences and perspectives, and very much talking about, like, well, how do these oppressions that we struggle with, racism and classism and homophobia, how does that affect our mental health? And then how, when we're activists in those movements, how do we explain to the people around us that, hey, we can't just keep pushing ourselves? And we try, as because Icarus has, we have about 1.5 full-time staff, which is 27 people sharing that income. No, it's not quite that bad, but we all work really part-time, which is typical. We get paid part-time, but then we work a lot more. And we deal with this all the time. There's people who don't make meetings, people who just drop out, you don't hear from them. And so we try and set it up in terms of an inspiration-based pace. There's periods where we're just not inspired to do anything and people are dealing with their stuff. And so, and then there's times when, like, wow, hypomania, let's write some grant proposals. Let's, like, go and do, you know, we really try and follow a rhythm that's not a machine rhythm, but it's a human rhythm and an organic. And I tell you, when the full moon is happening, I get interesting text messages from my coworkers. There's all kinds of really exciting stuff starts to happen with the cycles of the moon and all the different, like when the eclipse happened recently, it was like, wow, there's a lot of cool organizing going on. So so that, I think part of it is one of the things that I imagine that I'm doing and that Icarus Project is trying to do is really remembering that we're wild creatures, that we're animals, that we're natural beings. And a lot of the problem with the mental health system is squeezing people into these conveyor belt boxes of you have to work and you have to show up and you have to. And I think some of that is good, and I've thrived on that sometimes. But other times, there's no way. There's just no way. And that doesn't mean that I'm less of a valuable person in society. That means my ability is diverse, that my ability is different than most people, and we have to figure out a way to accommodate my ability so that I'm part of this diversity as well. So we are at about 9 o'clock now, so we should think about closing up. So,
well, can I say on behalf of all of us, I hope, thank you very, very much to all the presenters. It's been a great evening.
So check out the books that we have for sale, the Process Workbooks and the Icarus Project books. Sign up on the email sign-up sheet, and feel free to take some of the little cards that are there too. So, and people, I'm hanging out, so people want to talk with me, or you can get in touch with me by email. So,
thank you all very much for coming.